left here and grew up on a small island in the East China Sea. After 3 years spent farming in a mountain village commune, she attended Beijing University. In 1985, she left China to study in the United States, earning her PhD from NYU in New York. She is the acclaimed author of the short story collection American Visa, the novel Foreign Devil, several poetry collections, Spirit, and The Magic Wit, and a cultural study which she presented in part at Naropa some years back called Aching for Beauty, Foot Binding in China. Her recent book is The Last Communist Virgin. Wang Ping is now living in St. Paul, Minnesota, and teaches at McAllister College. And she's teaching a workshop this week entitled Fragments and Collages, Writing of Interwoven Genres. So welcome, Wang Ping. Then we have to Ping's left, Pavla Yonsanova. And Pavla's here teaching a class toward a minor literature, Bohemians Like Us. This class will use the theories of Deleuze and Guattari about the revolutionary potential of minor literature, exploring Czech Bohemian literature, its roots, rhizomes, and transformations until now. She started an all-woman punk band in 1980. The group became Dybbuk in 1983, and then transforming into Zubi Neti, which means tooth and nail. And has been involved with this special woman's poetics ensemble. All the members of the group were writing music and lyrics. They produced 5 albums, 4 soundtracks for theatrical performances, 2 books of poetry, and a film for television. Yonsanova taught at the pedagogical faculty of the Charles University English Department. She's dedicated to supporting creative women. She publishes interviews and articles about women artists and lectures on gender topics. And Pavla's also been working with our study abroad program in Prague, which Lisa Berman directs. And so she's also been to Naropa in the past few years, and we're very happy to welcome her back. And of course, she went through the Velvet Revolution. Then we have Stephen Taylor, who we all know, but let me give you the details again. Musician, poet, member of the seminal poetry rock group The Fugs, longtime collaborator with Allen Ginsberg and many other poets, worked recently with Lawrence Ferlinghetti on a radio play, and he's presently setting some of Kerouac's Some of the Dharma to music. He's the author of False Prophet, Field Notes from the Punk Underground from Wesleyan University Press. Before coming to work at Naropa full-time in 95, he did his doctoral work in ethnomusicology at Brown University, where he specialized in North American popular music and cultural studies. He teaches theory and poetry here in the history of the avant-garde. He traveled extensively with the Fugs and with the False Prophets rock group, and traveled with Allen Ginsberg to places abroad that were going through some cultural and political unrest. But we invited him today to come and talk to us a little, bring Julia Kristeva into the mix before we go on with the other guests. So why don't you lead us off, Stephen?
This came together very quickly, so I don't goes like this. So the topic today is revolution, rebellion, resistance, which is an aspect of the broader theme of the week having to do with the value of what we do as artists, and I thought I would say something about that. It's a huge topic because it describes a whole multi-millennial discussion about the place of art in society. For present purposes, I will speak briefly of 3 people, all of whom were associated in various ways with revolution or resistance in their time, and whose work may be of interest to you with regard to the question of the value of what we do as artists. First, I want to say something about the linguist Roman Jakobson. He was associated with the Russian futurists. He was a poet himself and a friend of Mayakovsky, and so he's in there with the poets. And then after he ran away from Stalin, he was part of the Prague circle of linguists. And finally, after he ran away from Hitler, he had a long career in the United States. He's a major figure across several disciplines, and he said things that enabled a younger theorist, Julia Kristeva, to connect literature to politics in the aftermath of the rebellions of the spring of 1968. that's massively reductive, but it's a little different for a start. This will all be massively reductive. Can I explain this without 4 hours and a blackboard? I'll try. It's 1960, and Jacobson's at a conference of linguists and scholars of literature, and he's asked to give the closing talk of the conference, and the topic he is given is, what makes a verbal message a work of art? Got it? What makes a particular instance of language an example of art? And what he's going to say is that what makes a verbal message a work of art is the poetic function. And the setup is an instance of language requires a speaker or addresser, a listener or addressee, and a message. That's the complete circuit for the language event. And you can substitute writer and reader here, of course. Between the two, there is a message, a word, a phrase, a sentence, a poem, a story, whatever. So that's the setup. Addresser, message, addressee. And of course, in the conversation, the addresser and the addressee switch places and so forth. A message is not a simple thing, because there's always a context and, shall we say, a subtext. Maybe some doubt about exactly what is meant, or some emotional charge, or some implication of who I think you are in relation to me. This is what is meant by the various functions that are present to some degree in all messages. What happens is that in any given message, one function is dominant, and the others play lesser roles. Give an example. Okay. I say, I want to see you at that meeting on Thursday. If the simple referential function dominates, you think, okay, I need to be at a meeting. Under that, maybe the emotive function. There's something emotionally charged behind that. He said that sort of originally. Well, a metalingual function comes into play. Meaning fails, and you say, wait a minute, did you say you want me after the meeting or at the meeting? And so on. Sometimes the phatic function dominates, which is the emphasis on the contact between us rather than any real information. What we are saying to each other is unimportant and may even be nonsensical because the conversation is not about anything other than our wish to be in contact. And Jacobson gives an example of his Dorothy Parker story where there are these two young people who are very enamored of one another, and he walks her home and she says, well, here we are. And she says, yes, here we are. And he says, well, you got that right. We're here. And it goes on and on and on. The information is not important. What's important is they don't want to stop the contact. Now, so you might say that each message has a kind of profile where one function dominates and the others make up the background, various kinds of mixed background. Now, Jacobson says there's one type of message profile that is different, and that is when the poetic function dominates. The poetic function has to do with the message as such. It calls attention to the fact that you're getting a message, and when you do that, things get strange. The poetic function has to do with the message as such. It emphasizes that what is happening is a message. The poetic function invokes a split. Jacobson says, and I paraphrase here, this function, by promoting the palpability of signs, deepens the fundamental dichotomy of signs and objects and gives the experience of a double, ambiguous shape, rendering addresser, context, message, contact, code, and addressee ambiguous. The poetic function destabilizes the whole scene. It renders not only the message strange, but also the speaker, the language itself, and the listener. Everything goes into flux to some extent, and I'll come back to this in a moment because this is key to the association of art with social change. Jacobson associates the poetic function with musical effects, pointing out that the impact or longevity of a simple phrase may be boosted by poetic constituents such as rhyme and rhythm. And he gives a couple of examples. One example he gives is the phrase, innocent bystander, innocent bystander. The music of the phrase makes it attractive, memorable, in a word, poetic. Another example would be Dwight D. Eisenhower's presidential campaign slogan, I like Ike. The music of it makes it stick. But there's a kind of threshold, a level of poetic language where the message is not simply emphasized or made memorable, but is made strange. As Julia Kristeva has it, musicalization pluralizes meaning. Musicalization pluralizes meaning. Here we can begin to see the political aspect of poetic language, because any situation of coercion or dominance tends not to want plurality of meaning. It wants one version of reality and seeks to repress anything that demonstrates that meanings can be many. Fascists don't like abstract painting. It's off-message, so to speak. Well, this is a vast simplification which you get the idea. Morose delectation Aquinas' tongue belly calls this frate porco ino and fallen Adam will did not rutted call away let him by quarrels dainty is language know it worse than this monk words merry beads jabber on their girdles rogue words tough nuggets pattern in their pockets. James Joyce. To be reductive again about the whole thing, let's say that in conventional terms, one of the signs of good writing, in old-fashioned novelistic terms, let us say, one of the signs of good writing, as with good painting of a certain era, is that the medium is supposed to vanish. You read the novel, and you're there, in the dining room, thinking with the protagonist, or in the landscape, watching the shepherd asleep under a tree. Ideally, you're not thinking, I'm seeing words, I'm looking at a picture. But when the medium itself is brought to the fore, the message is troubled. As in Joyce's passage, you can't read that and vanish into the movie. It makes you self-conscious. It makes you question what's going on. Modernism did this. It came about at a time of rapid change and turbulence in the early years of the bloodiest century in human history. It happened at a time when ideas about what a person is were called into question by, on the one hand, the arrival of modern psychology, and on the other, slaughter on an unprecedented scale. The short version is, when you mess with language, you're messing with everything. The personal subject, says Kristeva, is a subject in language. I, she says, is quite literally the subject of a sentence. So the poetic function, the intrusion of music into meaning, troubles naturalized categories of sign, self, and state, and so may be an agent for change. She says, poetic language is an unsettling process, when not an outright destruction, of the identity of meaning and speaking subject. On that account, it accompanies crises within social structures and institutions, the moments of their mutation, evolution, revolution, or disarray. The poetic makes apparent the mechanism, like Toto pulling back the curtain on the great and powerful Oz. The poetic denaturalizes institutions, making of them mere customs, which appear curiouser and curiouser. So the answer to Jacobson's audience is that what makes a verbal act into art is that which makes the speaker, the spoken, and the hearer strange. Now to finish up quickly with the third person in this strange trio, we can state the above position more simply with reference to the work of Theodore Adorno. In his last book, Aesthetic Theory, Adorno speaks of what he calls genuine art on an analogy taken from Homer's Odyssey. Ulysses is away at the war, and he's been gone for years and years, and his queen Penelope and their son Telemachus are at home holding down the fort, as it were. Since Penelope's the queen, she has a very cool palace and a large estate and lots of sheep and so on. She's the wealthiest person in the country, and that makes her a desirable woman. Also, she's beautiful. So all these young men are hanging around saying, your husband's been gone so long, he must be dead, he's never coming back, you should marry one of us. And they're getting more and more aggressive, and they're camped out on the property, slaughtering the sheep and having big rowdy parties and generally being a nuisance. Telemachus is too young to drive these guys off the property, so she's stuck. Her only allies are her son, their old father-in-law, and the servants, so she keeps putting them off. She says, I'll decide which one of you to marry when I finish this weaving. She's weaving a funeral shroud for the old man. And she says, I have to do this, and when it's finished, I'll decide which one of you guys to marry. All day, she sits at her loom weaving, and all night she picks the weaving apart. This is Adorno's metaphor for art. Art is never complete. There is no last word. It does not define some sort of final truth. It undoes all attempts at finality. It does not have all the answers. To go back to Penelope's weaving, it perpetually puts off the bullies who want everything settled once and for all. It says, look, here's a situation that is not nailed down. It says, here is a painting, a poem, a made-up thing. Art is frankly artificial. It hints that maybe our world situation also is made up. Maybe everything is not fixed. Maybe there are many ways to do things. Remember, I said music pluralizes meanings. This is another way of saying it. It says things don't have to be the way they are. The interesting thing to me in this is that it regards art as political apart from its content and apart from the intentions of the artist Bakhtin talks about this. A novelist may be quite conservative in her views, but if her novel presents a plurality of voices, what Bakhtin calls the heteroglossia of the novel, the work is larger than the artist's intentions. So those are my thoughts.
Stephen. Pavla, would you
sort of take over with something not theoretical at all, but rather sharing with you some of the actual situation in my country, the Czech Republic. So just before I boarded the plane, I went to a perm placement of the greatest guru of the underground culture, Egon Bondy, a philosopher and poet. Also, he wrote a book on the Buddha. And so that was a very kind of strange moment, because the figure of Egon Bondy is kind of at the moment surrounded by many foggy stories about his collaboration with the secret police, and which it seems that very probably when things are really investigated, it will come to almost nothing. But the fact remains that Egon Bondy was the father, the mentor of all the heroes, like the plastic people of the universe. And he was mentoring them, teaching them, drinking beer with them every night at Nerudova Street. And right after the so-called Velvet Revolution, he disappeared. The official version was that he went to Bratislava to protest the division of Czechoslovakia into Czech lands and Slovakia. But in fact, he was almost like a Kafkaesque figure who was kind of expelled from his community by his past actions. I think that this kind of shows the difficulties, ambivalences connected with the so-called Velvet Revolution. If I would try to find some proper term for what happened in November 1989, when students walked on the 17th of November on a march that kind of started a week of euphoric demonstrations that eventually took over the media on their side and kind of brought about the end of the regime. Some historians would call it fall of communism. Some call it a switchover. I think we're still kind of waiting for some terms to appear, what actually happened. There was a lot of discussion in connection with the 30th anniversary of Charter 77, the civic rights movement that basically change the consciousness of the country to really be ready for the switch. I would see that that so-called Velvet Revolution, as if I guess any revolution would have like a triangle that would have three parts, and on the bottom would be a sort of economic revolution. Where, if you can imagine the hugeness of it all in Russia and the whole East Bloc, when everything was state-owned, and there has to be devised a scheme to restitute it, to privatize. So this was an incredible revolution. Then on the second higher level is politics, the revolution politics, and on the top would be some kind of symbolic layer which we could refer to as some kind of mindset. And here many people would conclude that the revolution has completely failed, and that is why we are not even really entitled to call it a revolution. I would have a comparison with the French Revolution, which I think was more in that symbolic realm, that there were actual changes in the mindset, and we see it very visibly in all the left-wing French intellectuals of the 20th century, who kind of surf on this wave of the ideas of the French Revolution, that you can change the world, that it is possible to do that. It's only logical. It just, we've seen it, we've been there, we've done it. Whereas the Czechs and I would say majority of the former communist camp, as if the deformed tradition of left-wing thinking in any form, Marxism, would just, I'd be condemned, so you would have thinkers like Slavoj Žižek, who just would not be translated because he's too left-wing. You would have George Soros, who wanted to establish a university in Prague, and he was, the nomenclature of the government was so scared of this leftish Jewish intellectual that they just didn't let him build the university there, and he had to build it in Budapest. So there would be these deep feelings of dissatisfaction and still situation which is quite chaotic, and I would say not really in some logical flow of events. We're still waiting for some new forms of resistance. To give you a practical example, let's take a look at street art, graffiti art. So our best known graffiti artist, Point, Cákes or Splash, is a fantastic artist. There's undoubted, if you want to check out his stuff at onepoint.co. But totally apolitical. He just does it just for this kind of pure joy, whereas if we compare it with graffiti in the United States, so at least as far as I was able to understand it, so it is a pretty political genre of art. So we see that the so-called Velvet Revolution completely failed. Then we see the total downfall of certain groups like the Romanis, or politically incorrect, the Gypsies, who suddenly found themselves unemployable, living in ghettos, basically living in this kind of usury tribes. Women who throughout the so-called socialist project became very equal in higher education, and of course all of them worked, 100% or 99% of women worked, and suddenly the return to traditional values after 1990 kind of brought them into like a weird place. So there's these perfect professionals, and yet they're kind of supposed to return somewhere 100 years ago, or it's just like a very bizarre situation, which connected with globalization is a problematic. The sort of counterbalance is, of course, the resistance is the beginning of creation of civic society, of creation of all NGOs, of the what we call the public benefit corporations, that immediately mushroomed to alleviate all these new, newly created problems, including homelessness. I would just say that, speaking about poetic functions, so the most powerful slogan of the so-called Velvet Revolution was Havel's slogan, "Love and truth will win over lies and hatred." So that was like this kind of powerful catchphrase that everyone tuned into. But looking back at it 17 years after that, it just has completely evaporated and seems to be empty and false. Almost as if Havel kind of is continuing in writing his garden party, where he makes fun of the empty communist phrases, of how language can be used in this formalized way and meaning nothing. I think my time is up, so I'll just end with a sort of my personal revolutionary account. And I think that we're kind of brothers in arms with Stephen, that we belong to the sort of punk generation, where I just saw an amazing documentary by Don Letts, a British filmmaker, called Punk Attitude. And in his understanding, the punk attitude is this kind of challenging authorities, like standing behind your word, doing something maybe very simply, brutally simply and primitively, but there is this energy. So that, I guess, would be where I feel that that's my strength, my energy, where it comes from this punk attitude. And this is what I want to continue in when I'm writing my articles, trying to support movements and artists that I think are absolutely necessary to really make the revolution happen, to sort of work in the symbolic region. So basically I taught myself to play guitar, like just listening to Patti Smith. She said, "Oh, I just practiced to the Ramones. This is a wonderful band." So I thought, well, I'll never play guitar like Paco de Lucia or Jimi Hendrix, but I can play the Ramones. And that was, you know, and that was enough. And it gave me like an incredible power. I felt really, really great about it. I could go on. Maybe one last thing about the visual revolution. So we know that there's been lots of like feminist filmmaking in the 70s, and I'm inviting Laura Mulvey, the sort of greatest recognized feminist theorist, to Prague to speak in October, and there will be a similar panel which will be called Revolution Women and Revolution in Film, and I'm so excited about that. Because, of course, we have these fantastic women filmmakers. I hope that you might heard about the Daisies by Věra Chytilová, but there's quite a number of them. And recently I did an interview with Věra Chytilová and asked her about whether she felt sorry that throughout the 70s she wasn't able to come to the festivals because there was the Iron Curtain, that she couldn't have kind of participated in developing the discourse. And she said, "Haha, well, I understand that these Western women filmmakers felt discriminated against because they wouldn't let them do a regular feature movie. They had to do everything DIY at home on their knees, but I was given like limitless budget. So yeah, if the script was approved. So yeah, so there. I hope that even that meeting with Laura Mal will kind of push things forward, and I have best hopes that a symbolic revolution will happen in my country and everywhere. And I hear the year is 2012. That's the prophecy, isn't it?
Ming, take us to China.
Well, I guess I have to start with China with Mao. Mao's quote. I grew up during Cultural Revolution, and I grew up singing this famous Mao's quote that this revolution is not a dinner invitation. It is making thunders. Yeah, that's his famous words. Yeah. And we grew up dancing these words and singing among them. And what he meant is really just like bloodshed. So, but there's some great truth in it. The revolution is really about breaking all the walls and breaking borders, constantly cross borders, and the border of personal border, and family border, the social border, hierarchy, and then the largest is the national border, right? That America is building lots of the biggest border fence probably on Earth to prevent migration, and which is happening anyway, and which is actually making the biggest revolution, global revolution, that's the mass revolution. So what I want to when I had a photo exhibition in St. Paul about the Three Gorges Dam, and this is my first art exhibition, and I have no experience as an artist, and I stumbled upon photography as I stumbled upon writing. And one of the artists came to the show told me, "You are Wang Ping." And we met the first time. She looked around and said, "You are a rule breaker." And I just laughed, and we just started laughing, you know. And I always thought I was a rule breaker because I had no formal education, basically, except for Beijing University. 4 years, really pretty intense formal education. Then I went to New York. The PhD is basically self-study, basically. But for Cultural Revolution started when I was second grader, and all the schools were just stopped to make revolution. Mao's words is stop revolution, stop production to make revolution. I think the world actually needs that. We need kind of like stop production a little bit, you know, stop consumption. And because of no formal education, I never have much rules, you know. And I thought I was quite a revolutionary, you know, revolutionarist. And until actually last month when I was doing the MAFA Lenin residency, and doing a 5-week residency, and I visited Donald Judd's museum. And he has those boxes in two barns, like huge, gigantic barns, with all the windows glass, except for the top. And everyone was making a big fuss about it. And I went with other writers in residency, other poets, and you know, there are many artists in MAFA. And we went there, and we looked around, and just saw like boxes of boxes in aluminum, polished. And they look like coffins. So I thought maybe he was trying to, you know, use these boxes as a symbol to, because it was the old site of German war prisoners. And then I went back and said, what are these words talking? So what is trying to say? What is he trying to capture? in these boxes. And then I heard the sunrise will bring a lot of meaning to these boxes. So I went there at 6 o'clock with other artists. And we were in, it's like a privilege. We were let in with the key. Because there are gates and another gate, you know, and fence. It's a huge place. And there was not much to see, just still the boxes. And we were just very disappointed. What is going on? And I walked around and I walked around. So like, I really felt I was walking, circling the cemetery, because those boxes really look like graveyards. And then suddenly I said, I need to get out of the building. I need to get out of the box. It sounds such a cliche, thinking out of the box. But at the moment, it is not a cliche. I walked out with my camera and circled the building 3 times. Just when the sun was rising too high for to create any reflection or shadows, I captured this moment in the corner. The sun was reflecting things against the brick wall, and the brick wall, the light bounces onto those metal boxes. And I saw a glimpse of something, and I captured, click, click, click. I only had time to click 5 photos. And I went home and put it on the monitor. The images that came out shocked me, and I was very, very shocked, because I thought I could see a lot with my eyes, but the camera could see much more. And what I saw is the total breaking, the walls disappeared. Okay? And all I saw is reflection upon the reflection. The nature, natural world, the trees, the grass, the animals, the fences, all reflected, entered, breaking through the wall, entered those boxes, and bounced out. So the interior and exterior totally mixed up, blended together. The world became not just two-dimensional, became 3, 4, 5, 6, even 7, 8, just infinite folds. And I was very, just like, it really took my breath away. So I went back, I was begging those people, Tinati, those foundation people, let me in one more time at sunset, and I captured a lot, and said, I need to go back again, sunrise. So I went back again at sunrise, and just incredible. So if you want to see this, I brought those, some of those, just really incredible. Then he sent me up saying, I realized there are a lot of ghettos inside me. Okay, the ghettos of the language I thought I broke when I started writing in the second language, in English. Because when I started writing, I wrote in 2 languages, Chinese and English. And very quickly, I found that my English language, English poems, were much bolder, freer, and a lot of subjects I could never imagine or dare of thinking of writing in Chinese, I could do in English. And immediately, I thought, this is quite revolutionary. I realized that language, my Chinese mother tongue, was a whip that's been constantly whipping me behind me in my unconsciousness, telling me what to see, how to see things, what to think of, how to think of things. So when I wrote in English, even though my vocabulary was very limited, I did not have that whip. I was free. I was a child in playing in this huge sandbox. And even though my toys were limited, I could just make like Legos. I could, you know, make any kinds of toys because I had no rules, no whips. And so that follows that, you know, that realized that how my eyes have been trained to see things at two-dimensional, you know. And so I think in our writing or making things as an artist, we really have to break those boxes, have to like, literally get outside of to think and to see things outside those boxes, and also to break down the walls of barriers. And unfortunately, I don't know, you know, the MFA is a great thing, you know, and creates a lot of like readers and great writers. But at the same time, this has to do with revolution, right? You know, we always say the another cliche is starving poets, right? You know, and, you know, starving poets actually are revolutionaries. You know, when you know, how do people make revolutions? It's very hard to make revolution in America because we always somehow manage to get, you know, to get fed, to get food, like food stamps. You know, in China we have so many revolutionaries because we have this another cliche or old saying, Guan Pi Ming Fan, is when the officials, like, you know, cornered you against the wall when you have nothing to lose, right? You know, you either starve to death or you make a revolution and you may become a king, an emperor, you know. So those peasants, you know, chose to do an uprising, you know. And so usually revolution starts at the bottom when you have nothing to lose, you are performing so low. You know, you have no choice but cross the bridge, you burn the bridge, you have no retreat, just charge forward. Okay, and that's, I think, all are those, you know, migrants do, you know. And this research I've been doing for years is there are 250 million migrant workers within China alone making products for, you know, all the big boxes, America and European markets, right? And what does that mean, you know, in terms of global, the Chinese economy, industry, and global economy? And also from, you know, all over China, but also mostly along the east coast, southeast coast of China, you know, there are like thousands, tens of thousands of people constantly cross the ocean to enter the United States. And this is another, you know, major, you know, research projects I've been doing, you know. But they are related. The internal migration in China and the international crossing of the ocean, you know, the borders, the ocean, and entering the richer, you know, a more economic advanced countries. You know, what are they trying to do, you know, right? And I think they are trying to break the economic hierarchy. And that is also a revolution. Now, how we as an artist try to connect these, right? You know, either content-wise and also as, you know, artistic-wise, you know, form-wise, you know. So in my own writing, I basically break all the rules. You know, people really don't know what to think of my writing. You know, it's not really poetry, it's not prose, it's not fiction. Fortunately, I have a great publisher, Coffee House, Alan. He's so revolutionary in terms of publishing. You know, try not to put me in a box, you know. So he just let me do whatever I want to do, right? And, but basically for me, I think, you know, when I think about this topic, revolution and resistance, you know, when it comes to art, I constantly, people often accuse me of, you know, this is not poetry, this is fiction, and fiction writing, people say, this is not poetry, fiction, this is poetry. And I often think, this, what is the internal conflict in the writing, right? You know, basically we have two instincts, you know, as human and as artists. One is narrative, which is basically linear, telling the instinct to tell a story, the linear one, right? The time moving from, you know, morning till evening, from 0 to 10. And the other is lyrical moment, which is supposed to be poetry. And to me, this lyrical moment is this explosion of emotional charge, as Steve mentioned before, you know. For me, they can coexist. You know, you can't really totally separate the narrative in a poem or in any poem. Of course, narrative stories is always about narrative. And you can't really take lyrical moment to stop this time to explode, right? You know, this intensity you build in poetry, you build, you know, this lyrical poem moment until, like, you can't hold it anymore than this huge explosion of emotion. You know, they always coexist. And, you know, but how do you, as this, the job of an artist, how to, like, keep the balance and build this momentum until this final explosion? I think my time is up, and I can talk more later. So.
Hey, thank you all. I just want to maybe have a little few moments to hear if you want to speak amongst ourselves. But I was going to ask before we open it up, and I wanted to say for newcomers, you come to the mic in the back and state your name for the archive, and then address your question. When I first came to the Czech Republic with Alan, and so fortuitously met you, Pavla, I was very aware of your almost an underground community of artists and writers who were in touch and yet were restricted in some of the things you could read or do or meet or kind of, and there seemed to be with our friend Martin Markovic a kind of, you know, there'd been almost a paranoia, a psychological effect on the, you know, people of that generation who had been maybe thwarted or prevented. I mean, here was a brilliant thinker and writer who was working, I think, is in the post office and, you know, leading a kind of, you know, very restricted life in some ways. I visited people's homes where you had texts under the floorboards. You know, in Howl, for example, Allen Ginsberg's poem was in these very well-read Xerox, not Xerox, but carbon copies. Remember carbons? Carbon copies that had been, you know, read quite a bit. There were, I think,
some is done.
Yeah. And records, and, you know, Bob Dylan, or many of the writers of the Beat Movement, and so on. So maybe to speak about what that was like in terms of a community that was had some restrictions. How did you work within that?
Yeah, just when you mentioned your visit, that was in 1991. Yeah, that I had it on my list that I wanted to mention it because it kind of symbolized this total euphoria that we lived in. And of course, such things as Allen Ginsberg and Waldman would be performing at the Lucerna and everywhere else. It was just the time, I guess, was really very, very unforgettable. And the paranoia was mainly in a generation that was a little bit older than me, that really kind of got the worst repression of the 70s, and me as a teenager of the 80s, where the situation was gradually improving, and with Gorbachev then coming in, it was much easier. So it's true that, for example, Martin Machovec, who was part of the underground circle and who basically devoted all his life to a mission of editing underground literature. His book, Views from the Inside, is available. It's a wonderful collection of essays of the main heroes of the Czech underground in English. And he's working more and more. And so this was his childhood friends, so he was very close to them, and let's say Egon Bondi was his mentor, sort of his, like his father. And the plastic people of the universe, when they got out of jail,
that was a rock group.
Yeah, the rock group. And of course,
not some aliens from a Jack Spicer fantasy.
Yeah, of course, I imagine that what is in my head is also in your head. So, kind of. of course, I like as a young woman, I really wanted to be friends of theirs in the 80s when I joined the music scene. But they were just so close, so cautious, so paranoid. And some of them emigrated because they said that they can't stand living in a country that treated them so badly. And then I saw a little bit of opening up of that paranoid fear, where they would be able to sort of reach out and speak with other people. And it was clear that the Russians will not bring their tanks again. and they will not go to jail. So in that sense, people do feel that the freedom of speech is kind of like really a great benefit.
And people stay in touch after things continued? I mean, did it shift the connections?
Well, Martin Machovec would claim that the end of the underground culture in Czechoslovakia is 1989. And I am not sure whether this is quite right, because there was lots of like momentum with some of the samizdat illegal underground publications that still would be coming out for maybe 5 years after 89 and bringing some really fantastic stuff. And so that kind of doesn't work. And then there's lots of young kids who would kind of treasure this legacy and would kind of thrive on that and would have similar names. They wouldn't be PPU, but BBB, and have the similar kind of poetics used, and would always emphasize how deeply grateful they are to their predecessors and so on. So I would say it does continue, the underground culture, on a certain like, sort of low scale level, unnoticeable, as one of our now most interesting philosophers, Václav Bělohradský, would say, nobody is listening in postmodern world.
Do you
have any questions? I was just thinking about traveling around Europe. I was in Poland. I was in Poland a lot with Alan on behalf of one of the things that Ginsberg did was he was on a committee of the Pen Club called the Freedom to Write Committee. And so as he was touring around in Europe and Israel and other places, wherever there was instances of literary censorship or writers in difficulty, he would investigate on behalf of the Pen Club, and had a lot of experiences in Poland in the 1980s with the kind of breakdown of the regime and the idea that the underground economy eventually became the economy, in the sense that everybody had to buy into it because that's how you got your bread, you know. So, for example, we were taken by the American Embassy. At that time, if you were traveling in the Eastern Bloc, as an artist, you were, USIS was involved, the U.S. Information Service, which we refer to as CIA Light. It was basically sort of idealistic, but also art-sharing artists and representing America as artists. Now, Ginsberg got invited by the USIS, I don't know. We were doing that, and we were in an embassy in Warsaw, and we met all these people. There's Polish officials, and they said, this is the head of, you know, Polish television, this is the head of state radio, this is somebody who's very high up in the publishing world, it's all state controlled. And then they said, somebody said, you know, would you like to meet the underground? And we went to some secret location, and it was all the same people we already met, and, you know, everybody was living these dual lives, and it sort of eventually fell apart. Also, much experience of artists involved, particularly in Poland, in theater, because of the importance of the theater in that place. So that all of the cities would have theater companies, and theater companies would be involved in things like, if you were putting on a play, you would have two scripts, because the censor would come on opening night. So you play that script on opening night, and then later on, when the censor's not around, you play the B script. They would also do things like they would buy up editions of books that had been censored, and they had little tapes, little sticky tapes with the words that had been cut out. They would sit there and tape the words back into the text, you know. Tremendously active, tremendously important theater gatherings. Discussion groups, you know, we've just done a play, come to the discussion group, and the discussion group wouldn't be about the play at all. It would be about social conditions and things like that. But it does seem that that lower part of the pyramid, the whole economic thing, really shifted. I was not in Prague, I never was in Czechoslovakia, but in Poland, that was my experience. The economic impossibility of sustaining this lie, as Václav Havel points out in his essay, The Power of the Powerless, in a society that is based on lies, simply speaking the truth is a revolutionary act.
It would be cool if you could say something about after Tiananmen, various some poets and artists were are living in exile and can't go home, such as Bai Dao.
Right. Yeah. That's definitely, you know, that's I think Bai Dao in a way could, how should I say it? You know, I'm just want to again about just use a metaphor of bound feet.
Right.
Bound feet. The Chinese woman on the surface at the first glance, they were extremely restricted, confined because of the bound feet. But that's the form, that's the border, right? You know, you strip the woman's whole spirituality, physical body in those 3-inch loaded shoes. But at the same time, you know, they can make revolution out of those 3-inch loaders. You know, they pour all their creativity, you know, they make great art, and they become extremely strong spiritually and physically and everything, mentally, you know, to for this kind of, to make revolution. And I'm just talking about it as a metaphor for Chinese literature, and because of the great restriction, censor, you know, so ironically, you know, talking about revolution, you know, Chairman Mao, when you mentioned that, you know, how to link art with, you know, politics, Mao is probably is also very revolutionary in terms of, you know, in the 1930s, in the famous Yan'an speech, you know, on art and politics, he basically raised the slogan, art must serve the politics, you know. And basically, he was not really that far from Socrates and Plato's. You know, they mentioned that art, you poets, you pick up the signals. You must have this antenna to pick up the signals, right? You know, and so, but at the same time, because of that, he made such strict borders that, like, he really literally smothered those poets and writers. And in that circumstances, you know, everything we say, we write, has to serve politics. And so people like Bai Dao in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, and just total darkness and total silence. And I think they started with the translation that we, you know, not we, but just people in China in general, that circled underground, most of them is handwritten, you know. And I remember I read handwritten copies of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Actually, what came to me as the biggest, like, dirty yellow pornography, you know. And if we were discovered, we would be like sent to prison. You know, and but it was like highly priced. But because of that, those words meant tremendously, the power of those words underground, because of this pressure, right? You know, you're like in a pressure cook. You know, these are only a few books you could put your hands on. And you read it 1 time, 3 times, 100 times until you memorize those words. And you can imagine the power of those words, you know. And now we're flooded with books, you know, very diluted, you know, the literature, you know. And what do you do? How much can we remember, really? You know, how much can we make out of that, you know? So under the pressure, the power of explosion is really great. So when Bai Dao and Gu Chen, those mystic school poetry, came out, it was this huge explosion. You know, and their poetry, now we look at them, is a little bit naive, you know, very simple. But at the time, historically, they were like served, right? It's like atomic bombs for us, you know, really, really important. And now we have basically pretty much freedom, you know, very little. We have some censorship, but just, you know, some. But actually, the more censor, if the government puts censorship on certain books, that book instantly become a bestseller. So it's actually, so it's the best way for the government to do is actually, if they want to get rid of certain poets and writers, to send them outside China, actually. That's what they did to Bai Dao, basically. You know, Bai Dao really wants to go back and live in China, but He can. Yeah,
yeah. Right. Okay, well, let's open it to questions. So come up to the center and...
Alicia Wood, the Icon. Wang Ping, you talked about the mother tongue being the whip that tells you what to say and what to think, and I have that also continually. And I was thinking about like that mother tongue is actually a silent tongue that is telling you what to say, and also how we speak like our own tongues in whatever language that is, and how that is political and revolutionary.
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, that's why I really urge people to learn another language. That opens a new world to you, and immediately try to translate, because in translation is the best apprenticeship you can ever do to become a writer and poet, and especially translate poetry. Because in poetry, language is so concentrated, you know, and the emotional charge, the intensity, the play of intensity, explosion is so strong, the highest, you know. And in order to translate, you know, you have to enter another language, which is the heart of a civilization, basically. And you come out a total different person.
Marie Snyder, hi. This is a collective question for everyone. In reference to the underground that you guys are talking about in your own countries, and if we put it back here into the United States, and you ask the question, like, what is the underground culture of today, and what exactly does it constitute, and what exactly do we need to pull and take from the culture that we're given currently here in the United States as truth or fiction?
I'll just tell you what occurs to me, that there are many undergrounds. It's difficult to identify in the United States because there's a sort of a homogenization in the media and a kind of ignorance of reportage or lack of reportage on any underground scenes. And there's also tremendous turnover because we've perfected the kind of co-optation of what's new. 5 minutes after Johnny Rotten appears in a torn Armani suit, Tiffany's is marketing diamond studding safety pins. You know, so you have to watch what it is. You have to see what it is. You have to see who's excluded, and you have to see it in your own scene. There's this idea of kind of the organic intellectual, the idea that you do your work where you happen to be. You know, and you cannot generalize, I think, an underground in the United States. There's many, many, many scenes. And you have to find them where they are and work with them in your own way. I don't know what else to say. There's the squatters. I mean, when I was active in New York City in the 80s, there was this, the whole squat scene, which was very much hidden compared to the squat scene in the European cities that I was visiting. So, you know, it's hard to spot the underground in the United States.
I had one feeling. Recently, a student of mine brought me a sort of feminist zine that was kind of describing female genitalia, how to take care of them, and so on. And there were these abortive plants mentioned and named exactly how to use them, where to find them, how to cook them, to conduct the abortion. And I felt that this, for example, could never be kind of abused by, maybe yes, by the media. You know, that this is like almost really raging on something illegal.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it was an incredible zine, like a very in-depth. I've never seen anything like that. I wish I had something like that when I was a young girl. And yeah, it's very radical, very, I think, underground because of really containing some illegal, like sort of criminal information.
Well, just the two poles to your question. One is America is like probably the most brainwashed nation in a way. And the difference, like, well, for Chinese, right, we know we're brainwashed.
You have to shake us at the same thing.
So we don't believe a word the government says. Enough said. And here we think we have freedom of speech. Okay? And the other, at the same time, we are very lucky that here, this is, I mean, United States is the most diverse culture you can ever have. You know, there's no other country like the United States. You have everything, it's like the United Nations. All kinds of food, all kinds of culture, all kinds of languages, you know, all kinds of things, like, just open your eyes, open your heart, embrace them. You know, especially don't look up, don't look down, and see how the ordinary people see, get into their houses, their apartments, see how they eat, what they eat, you know, and their hobbies. You will learn, you will see so much. This is really a great place to see different things.
Richard Schwass, this kind of follows on that question. I was really interested in your comment about, you know, there are no starving artists in America because we're so well fed. And I wonder, you know, we still have our, we have ostensible and even actual freedom of speech, but we have our corrupt government, military, we have, you know, terrible homelessness epidemic, we have a healthcare crisis, and we also have people transcending their genders and things like that. And I'm wondering, especially for Wang Ping, you teach here and you live here, what you've observed that might be considered social revolutions or evidence of social revolution in America, or maybe the West in general.
I didn't answer that.
Okay. Well, I think probably the illegal aliens, you know, the millions of people who are crossing border illegally, I think they are our hope. You know, they will change our infrastructure, our culture, our habit of a way of living, our way of thinking, profoundly. And nothing, no wall or fence can stop them coming. Yeah. You know,
no, I thought that was. You talked a little bit about this virtual fence, or you referenced it the other day, and all these plans afoot to, you know, cage and wall, and yes, there are these cages a la Guantanamo being built somewhere, I think in Nebraska. There's a Nevada.
The fence does not stop them, it only stops us, even within. You know, it makes us into, creates a ghettos. You know, we become a ghetto as a nation. The suburban ghettos, you know, and as an artist, we have to like break down this ghetto of fear, you know, to become an artist, a true artist. You know, but they are related.
But I think there is, you know, just that things are going to change inevitably in terms of these people crossing borders and in terms of certain communities defending and continuing what they need to do. I mean, you know, maybe there will be a time when the Supreme Court, as we see, is this whole issue of Brown versus Brown and bringing back a kind of like racist on an issue and integration. I don't know if you've been following that. The you know, the is Roe versus Wade next, and will people have to be trained? You know, women will be taught how to abort themselves, where it becomes, you know, back in the hands of the community rather than, you know, becoming sublegal and all that. It's quite interesting to see where it will go.
Okay. And also nature is forcing us. The global warming, the rising water will force the revolution.
You know? Good. I'm, you're so optimistic. Glad to have you here.
My name is Kelly Davies, and to say what that guy said, like, what's some stuff, like, evidence of revolution? I'm really into, like, performance, and when I see stuff like Borat and Dane Cook and Will Ferrell, that's, like, my kind of thing that I think that changes, you know, its own. And if those guys can create more space in their own way, you know, then I think that's going to allow for other people to have space to do what they want.
Yeah,
But where does the inspiration come from for a revolution?
What's your question? I'm sorry.
Where does the inspiration come from?
Well, it's all around you, I would say.
And, yeah.
I mean, it's in this room.
Yeah.
A lot of the people you encounter here, I think your cultural examples or performance examples are, you know, yes, so many people have broken down stereotypes.
Because I heard someone say that the only way that you want to change culture would be through art. And someone responded to them that there's other ways as well to change.
Well, I think, think about it and investigate it. There's a lot of thinking and study that's been done in this state.
It comes from the real conditions. I mean, Marx is right in that. I think that, you know, revolution doesn't happen because a bunch of poets decide we need a revolution. Revolution happens because the conditions become intolerable. When the real conditions no longer function, the conditions will change. So it may be that it's a total market collapse in the United States, you know, in the Western world, and that's what will change the condition.
Because I think we've kind of been programmed to think that we're just going to get whatever we want, and so that's been going on for a while now, and it just created a really lazy culture, you know. I think we have a pretty lazy, lazy culture. That's why I came here, it's because people want to do something here.
Great, good. You're here in the right place. We need to go on with a few more questions because we have to stop in a few minutes. quick, Jorge.
Several times throughout the panel, I've heard several, I guess probably because of the way that it's framed and the paper, people referring to the word revolution. And, you know, being a reader of Duncan and Levertov correspondence and poetry, I remember reading both of them writing poems and both of them in their letters arguing about that word revolution because it means circle, to go back to the beginning. So having said that, I don't think that's the right word, obviously, for the idea that we're striving after. When we try to reach beyond those desired or deeply longed for spaces and places and you know, aspects of our lives, because it means to go in a circle. And I posit, what is it? Perhaps we've just made the discussion too, we're only talking about revolution and that political aspect. And listening to, just coming up here to ask you this question, Akilah was asking last week, she's been saying that one of the things that she's been really involved with in her work lately is how to, collapse boundaries, how to collapse borders. And that metaphor you were sharing with us about seeing those boxes inside of that one place, reflect and sort of like break that box. Perhaps that's the type of revolution. The thing that we ought to be working for in each of our lives, not only in the political level, but on the linguistic one. Perhaps maybe the next revolution is to embrace the immigrant and see what their creativities are. Maybe that's the next underground.
Good, great. Revolution is a term that turns many ways. But I just want to say to you, we need to have these, some kind of vocabulary and language in order to discuss these things. And I think the word is very relevant today, and especially to the experience of two people on this panel, very personally and directly.
Sarah Grosjean. This is directed towards Wang Ting. People outside of the academic scene in China, for example, a band called Believers, just out of Beijing, will write about write a lot of songs, some that are in English and some that are in Mandarin or Cantonese. And a lot of the English songs will talk a lot about the corrupt government and also just about how they feel about freedom of speech and things like that. I'm just curious as how do you foresee the freedom of speech conveyed through art, developing or not developing in China as more people learn English and travel outside of their own country?
Well, they can't stop. How can they stop the tsunami waves? Tsunami comes, nothing, everything goes. So there's no way they can stop it. It's just a matter of time. The internet, China has the biggest firewalls, on the internet, but doesn't matter. all the information, you know, goes through. So revolution, in a way, literally starts from the language, right? You know, the information, you know, traffic.
Wang Ping, you said there are a lot of ghettos inside me, and that really moved me. And I wanted you to talk more about that and what that means to you. And I was wondering if Pavla and Stephen could talk about that as well, because it seems like that relates a lot to the underground, the literal underground.
Yeah, well, the ghetto I'm talking about just personally, right? The day we were born, we were putting a lot of walls, boundaries, you know, inside us, around us. We have to behave, we have to talk certain ways, right? We have to sit certain ways, we have to eat certain ways, we have to sleep certain ways, we have to make love certain ways. So all these boundaries, walls, right? And the biggest one is the fear, the ghetto of fear. You know, how we break through that. You know, and I've been thinking about Faust, actually. You know, the Faust is a very symbolic, metaphoric way of breaking this. You know, this when Faust signed that contract with devil, right? You know, and so all the things, the pleasures he can have, you know, except he cannot be satisfied, say, stop, I'm happy, you know. But that moment, explosion of satisfying, you stop time. That's the moment of poetry exploding, you know. And I think we all have to kind of sign the pact with devil to say we, in order to make this revolution, we must not be afraid signing this contract. We must not be afraid to be damned, you know. To say stop, you know. I want to explode. You know? So
the ghettos.
Yeah, I just have a little thing about the underground ghetto in the 70s, that it was referred to as a merry ghetto, because there was lots of joyful creativity connected with it, but that's the only merry ghetto I know about.
Anyone else? I think that's it. Thank you so much, and welcome.